Radio Onda Italiana präsentiert Voice of the Town. Informatie, Aktualitäten, eicherweise Musik. Mit Silvia Terribili. Auf Radio Salto Amsterdam, jeden Woensdagabend von 8 bis 9. Voice of the Town.
Thank you.
Goedenavond, beste luisteraars. En hartelijk welkom bij de uitzending van Radio Onda Italiana. Dit is Voice of the Town. En vanavond gaan we het hebben natuurlijk over het thema van de dag. En dat is, virus en het vaccin. En ik vind het belangrijk dat er ook kritische stemmen gehoord worden. En met name stemmen van mensen die echt goed gekwalificeerd zijn om dat te doen. Omdat de meeste mensen natuurlijk geen expert zijn op dit gebied. Helemaal geen expert. Nou, we hebben de virologen uiteraard. Maar ik vind het niet terecht dat alleen echte experts mogen beslissen voor iedereen. Dus we moeten ook luisteren naar de mensen die kritisch zijn. Een van deze is Peter Doshi. Hij is niet zomaar iemand. Hij is senior editor at the British Medical Journal. En hij is gebaseerd in Baltimore. Is ook associate professor of pharmaceutical health services research bij de Universiteit van Maryland School of Pharmacy. Zijn onderzoek is gefocust op het goedkeuren van medicijnen. Risico's en voordelen van medische producten. Hoe ze worden vastgesteld en gecommuniceerd. En hij wil graag de credibility en accuracy verbeteren. Dus de betrouwbaarheid en accuratesse van bewijzen. Hij doet campagnes voor een grotere transparantie van klinische trials, data. En hij is de leider van de Restoring Invisible and Abandoned Trials Initiatives. Hij heeft ook belangrijke belangen in journalistiek. Als vorm of verbeteren, het onderzoek verbeteren en de praktijken, verbeteren, medische praktijken. Hij heeft een fellowship in comparative effectiveness research bij de Johns Hopkins en hij verkreeg zijn PhD in historie, antropologie, science, technologie en society bij het Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dus hij is niet de eerste, de beste. En vooral hij is nog steeds senior editor at the British Medical Journal. Ik wil graag even laten horen wat hij afgelopen weken in het openbaar verteld heeft. En dat is zijn visie over de vaccinatiecampagnes. En met name gaat het over het verplichten van die vaccinatiescampagne. Het is een heel smart, zou ik willen zeggen, verhaal, openlijk, duidelijk. Je kan het niet verkeerd interpreteren. Hij zegt wat hij zegt. En het is Peter Doshi. We gaan er naar luisteren.
For identification purposes, I'm on the faculty of the University of Maryland and editor at BMJ. I have no relevant conflicts of interest and my comments today are my own. In pharmacy school, I teach a required course on how to critically appraise the medical literature. We train students on how to go beyond a study abstract and start to pick apart and critically assess biomedical studies, not just take them at face value. I want to use my 5 minutes here to harness that spirit of critical thinking. I'm saddened that we are super saturated as a society right now in the attitude of everybody knows, that has shut down intellectual curiosity and led to self-censorship. So let me start with a few everybody knows examples that I'm not sure we should be so certain about. Everybody knows that this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. But if hospitalizations and deaths were almost exclusively occurring in the unvaccinated, why would booster shots be necessary? Or why would the statistics be so different in the UK, where most COVID hospitalizations and deaths are among the fully vaccinated, as Senator Johnson said? There's a disconnect there. There's something to be curious about. There's something not adding up, and we should all be asking, is it true that this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated? What does that even mean? Next slide, please. Then there's this. Everybody knows that COVID vaccines save lives. In fact, we've known this from early 2021. The clinical trials proved that to be the case, as you can see here in the quote of a February article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. But is it true? When that statement by prominent public health officials was penned, there had been just one death across the 70,000 Pfizer and Moderna trial participants. Today we have more data, and you can see that there were similar numbers of deaths in the vaccine and placebo groups. The trials did not show a reduction in death. Even for COVID deaths, as opposed to other causes, the evidence is flimsy, with just two deaths in the placebo group versus one in the vaccine group. My point is not that I know the truth about what the vaccine can and cannot do. My point is that those who claimed the trials showed the vaccines were highly effective in saving lives were wrong. The trials did not demonstrate this. Next slide, please. Now let's talk about anti-vaxxers. Everybody knows you should discount what anti-vaxxers have to say, but what does the term mean? The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines it as, quote, a person who opposes the use of vaccines or regulations mandating vaccination. The first part of the definition, I expected. The second part stunned me. There are entire countries from the United Kingdom to Japan which do not mandate childhood vaccines. Both achieve high levels of vaccination, just not through regulations mandating vaccines. There are no mandates there, and I would wager that a large minority, perhaps a majority, of the world's population meets the definition here of an anti-vaxxer. Another definition worth checking is vaccine. Next slide, please. I am one of the academics that argues that these mRNA products, which everybody calls vaccines, are qualitatively different than standard vaccines. And so I found it fascinating to learn that Merriam-Webster changed its definition of vaccine early this year. mRNA products did not meet the definition of vaccine that has been in place for 15 years at Merriam-Webster, but the definition was expanded such that mRNA products are now vaccines. I highlight this to ask a question. How would you feel about mandating COVID vaccines if we didn't call them vaccines? What if these injections were called drugs instead? So here's the scenario. We have this drug, and we have evidence that it doesn't prevent infection, nor does it stop viral transmission. But the drug is understood to reduce your risk of becoming very sick and dying of COVID. Would you take a dose of this drug every 6 months or so for possibly the rest of your life, if that's what it took for the drug to stay effective? Would you not just take this drug yourself, but support regulations mandating that everybody else around you take this drug? Or would you say, hold on a sec. Maybe you'd say that if that's all the drug does, why not use a normal medicine instead? The kind we take when we're sick and want to get better. And why would you mandate it? The point is, just because we call it a vaccine doesn't mean we should assume these new products are just like all other childhood vaccines which get mandated. Each product is a different product, and if people are okay with mandating something simply because it's a vaccine and we mandate other vaccines, so why shouldn't we mandate this? I think it's time to inject some critical thinking into that conversation, and that is what I hope we're doing today. Thank you.
En dat waren de Coldplay in Clocks. En daarvoor luisterden we naar Pat Metheny. En we hoorden Peter Doshi, niet zomaar de eerste, de beste, senior editor at the British Medical Journal. Zijn verhaal is heel duidelijk. Zijn woorden zijn heel duidelijk. Je kan ze niet verkeerd interpreteren. Hij zegt, laten we het kritisch denken injecteren. Dus hij gebruikt een metafoor wat vandaag de dag heel actueel is. Kritisch denken, dat is belangrijk. Hij begint met die mantra's. Iedereen weet. Maar weet iedereen wat? Hij vindt dat experts op dit moment vaak zo zwaar beïnvloed worden door deze mantra's. Dus iedereen weet. Ze durven niet te zeggen, ja, ik denk wat anders. Er is een mate van zelfcensuur. En dat is heel ernstig, natuurlijk. Er zijn ook veel belangen, conflicten. Al die experts die praten, die wel een belang hebben bij de productie van vaccins bijvoorbeeld, of van tests, of wat dan ook, die hebben een belang. En dan moeten ze dat openlijk zeggen. En dat geeft ook natuurlijk ook een soort bias. Hè? Dus als je belang hebt, dan spreek je niet meer. Dan ben je zo zwaar beïnvloed door je eigen belangen. En dat is vaak, gaat het om enorme winsten natuurlijk. We weten dat er miljarden winst, dat Big Pharma's op dit moment miljarden winst maakt. Zij zijn de enige winnaars van deze pandemie, 2 jaar oorlog tegen de mensheid. Van een onbekende vijand, maar we weten wie de winnaars zijn. Dat zijn in ieder geval de grote farmaceutische bedrijven. Dus waarom zou je stoppen met het kritisch denken? Er is helemaal geen reden voor. Een ander iets. We weten allemaal dat dit een pandemie van de ongevaccineerden is. En wat Peter Doshi zegt, maar als het echt zo was dat alleen ongevaccineerden een probleem hadden, dus dat zij alleen maar ziek zouden worden, dat zij alleen maar in het ziekenhuis zouden belanden. Waarom moeten we zo hals over kop iedereen een booster geven? Dus juist de beschermde mensen. Dus dit blijkt ook dit is ook niet de waarheid. Een pandemie van de ongevaccineerden, dat klopt niet. Dat kan je niet bewijzen. Hè? Dus zowel gevaccineerden als ongevaccineerden kunnen ziek worden, kunnen besmetten, kunnen besmettelijk zijn. We weten dat vaccins na een aantal maanden veel minder efficiënt zijn, veel minder beschermen. En hoeveel ze beschermen, oké, daar kan je over. Daar zou je moeten meten. Dat wordt ook niet stelselmatig gedaan. Maar we weten dat het probleem voor beide groepen bestaat. Mensen die een derde booster krijgen, die staan in principe op hetzelfde niveau als ongevaccineerden. Want zonder die booster, dan zouden ze dezelfde risico's hebben. Hij pleit voor het analyseren van data. Hij zegt, ik heb niet de waarheid, maar je kan ook niet beweren dat je de waarheid hebt. En je kan andere experts niet censureren op basis van die waarheid die je denkt te hebben. En ik ga het ook over, uiteraard over het verplichten. Er zijn veel landen die zeker niet een vaccin gaan verplichten. Waarom doe je dat niet? In eerste instantie omdat het toch nog steeds een middel is in de experimentele fase. Die trials die eindigen over een paar jaar, dat kan ook niet anders. Want je kan niet weten wat de effecten zijn op lange termijn. Als je mensen niet test op lange termijn, hoe kan je dat weten? En je moet vooral ook een placebo-groep hebben, heel duidelijk. Hè, met die double-blinde experimenten. Als je dat niet hebt, dan kan je niet weten wat de effecten op lange termijn zijn. Die kunnen ingrijpend zijn. Dat weten we uit het verleden ook van andere medicijnen. Dus wat kort samengevat. De positie van Pieter Doshi is, hold on a sec, aan goed analyseren, niet meteen censureren, niet meteen doorgaan met mantra's, maar goed analyseren, goed nadenken. En natuurlijk heeft hij hele grote vragen over het verplichten. Want het verplichten, dat kan je in feite niet maken. En hoe zou je dat willen maken? Hoe zou je dat willen realiseren? Wil je geweld gaan gebruiken tegen mensen die toch blijven weigeren? Dat kan je niet verdedigen. Dat kan je absoluut niet verdedigen. Dat was zover wat betreft Pieter Doshi. We hebben straks nog een heel interessante reportage. Deze keer is het gemaakt door de Deutsche Welle nieuws. En het gaat over gain of function. Honey, you are a rock upon which I stand, and I come here to talk. I hope you understand. The green eyes, yeah, the spotlight shines upon you. And how could anybody deny came here with a load, and it feels so much lighter now I met you. And honey, you should know that I could never go. And I came here to talk. I think you should know. The green eyes, you're the one that I wanted to find. And
Are supercharged lab-enhanced viruses becoming a global threat?
Gain-of-function research?
Gain-of-function.
So-called gain-of-function research,
known as gain-of-function.
The controversy around so-called gain-of-function research has erupted alongside the heated debate around the coronavirus pandemic's origin.
It's a tale of two theories.
A lot of Democrats poo-pooed the whole idea of the lab leak.
Prominent public health experts saying that the lab leak theory, which was previously hawked by conspiracy theorists, might actually be credible.
This has moved high-risk gain-of-function research from the secretive shadows into the public spotlight. We've set out to investigate why, how, and where this type of research is being done, and what the risks and benefits are.
So what exactly is gain-of-function? It is a type of research that makes pathogens, like viruses, deadlier or more infectious to humans. The researchers intentionally modify the virus in lab experiments to give it new functions. For instance, the ability to spread by air or attack human nerve cells. Gain-of-function research seeks to make a virus more easily transmissible between humans, to increase the severity of the disease it triggers, or to make it resistant to existing treatments or vaccines. Sounds crazy?
Two main reasons are given for why this type of research is done. One is to better predict which viruses in animal populations might one day naturally mutate and become infectious for humans. The second is to be better prepared when a new pandemic hits, for instance, by already developing a vaccine for it preemptively.
There are obviously valid reasons for gain-of-function research, and the main reason is to understand pathogens better, to understand the way they transmit and behave, and thereby to make vaccines, drugs, etc.
So how many vaccines have been developed as a result of gain-of-function research?
None. There have been no preemptive vaccines to date.
Have any pandemics been prevented thanks to gain-of-function research?
The answer is not that I know of.
Not that I'm aware.
What's clear is that it didn't prevent this coronavirus pandemic.
Actually, none of the gain-of-function research that was done over the past decades or whatever, like none of it contributed to finding a vaccine or cure for SARS-CoV-2, for COVID-19. But in the future, there could be potential for that.
Some scientists think this is a perfectly legitimate endeavor. Others say it's akin to checking for a gas leak by holding a match to the gas pipe. In the effort to protect us from a pandemic, scientists could cause a pandemic.
So let's look a bit more closely at how gain-of-function research is done. One method is to genetically re-engineer pathogens by inserting genes from one virus into another to make it more aggressive.
Another simpler method is called animal passaging. Researchers inject a virus into ferrets or so-called humanized mice. These mice have been genetically manipulated to have human lung receptors. The virus undergoes slight mutations as it passes through several generations of mice. The scientists select the strongest mutations until the virus eventually becomes transmissible to humans.
The scientific technology today is so good that you can make a whole genome of a virus with no scars, no seams or anything. It looks perfectly natural.
In 2011, an extreme gain-of-function experiment rocked the science world. Scientists used the serial passaging method to make the H5N1 avian flu virus more transmissible to humans. The lead scientist, Ron Fouchier, claimed he created one of the most dangerous viruses you can make.
They had taken a virus that was deadly, but not good at infecting humans, and made it also very infectious. So that kind of research, I think, is the risk are immensely high. If it broke out, that would be just widespread death. But the benefits, what are they? Many scientists look at this experiment and they think, why? Why did you do this?
The thing with the avian flu is that it is extremely deadly, with an infection fatality rate of approximately 60%. Compare that to a rate of under 1% for COVID-19. Luckily, this virus hasn't leaked from a lab so far. But another worry is that a man-made virus like this one could end up in the wrong hands.
The main concern was the publication of the research, because once you publish it, then nefarious actors can also have access. It's like if you publish a method on the internet on how to hack a bank account, do you think someone's going to use it? Of course they're going to use it, right? And several, you know, terrorist groups have made their intention to use biological warfare known.
High-security BSL-4 labs built for research on highly infectious pathogens are booming around the world, and three-quarters of them are located in densely populated urban areas. Gain-of-function research is being conducted in some of these labs in the US, China, Europe, and other countries, although nobody knows for sure in how many of them. But surprisingly, gain-of-function experiments are not done exclusively in high-security BSL-4 labs. Some are done in level 2 and 3 labs.
We recently found out that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was doing a lot of this SARS-like virus research at a very low biosafety level. So at a level that you would feel unsafe working with airborne viruses, at BSL-2, you may or may not be wearing a lab coat. You definitely should be wearing gloves, but normally you don't wear a mask at BSL-2. So if you're working with airborne viruses, live viruses at BSL-2, viruses that can spread through the air, like SARS-CoV-2, then you are completely exposed. It was not an appropriate biosafety level for working with these SARS-like viruses.
Researchers at the Wuhan Institute of Virology were collecting and researching bat coronaviruses and using humanized mice prior to the COVID-19 outbreak. But the top researcher, Dr. Shi Zhengli, denies she was conducting gain-of-function research.
We know from all of the records, from the NIH grant applications, from papers published by the Wuhan Institute of Virology experts, that they were engaged in aggressive research and aggressive work that was making scary pathogenic viruses scarier, better able to infect human cells.
Dr. Shi, she says, we did not do gain of function research to increase infectivity, right? She picked out just the one. No, she didn't do to increase infectivity. She did to change the host range to make it infectious to us.
Making the disease the virus triggers more deadly is one possible aim of gain-of-function research. Another is to make a virus that would normally only attack animals better able to infect a different type of host, humans. What is making things murky is that different definitions of gain-of-function are circulating simultaneously.
The reason why it's so confusing and so complicated is because scientists do not know where to draw the line between regular experiments and gain-of-function experiments that are very concerning.
So it's only when there is a potential to cause harm to humans that it becomes gain-of-function research of concern.
But the question into the origins of the pandemic were stifled in early 2020 when an open letter was published in the medical journal, The Lancet. That effectively snuffed out all the debate.
They were very well intentioned, but even in the name of those good intentions, engaged in what I call scientific propaganda and thuggery, designed to drive consensus when the evidence didn't support that consensus.
It was basically trying to shut any scientific debate, and it was quite obvious. Because there is no way you can reach these conclusions when you don't have data.
People said that's a conspiracy theory. That's no conspiracy theory. That's an honest scientific possibility.
You'll probably note that most people who've been shouting down the possibility of a lab leak are virologists. And, you know... I'm not casting aspersions here, you know, there's many eminent virologists and we need them and their work is vitally important in especially in pandemics, but you've got to think about vested interests.
If this came from a lab, that means that science has led to millions of people dying by accident. So it's a very uncomfortable thing to think about. Unpleasant idea for scientists.
It wasn't until a group of citizen journalists began to investigate and analyze online databases that the lab leak theory re-emerged. The group, calling themselves Drastic, revealed that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was actively working with SARS-CoV-2 viruses over many years, including the closest known relative to the pandemic virus, using inadequate safety protocols. They also discovered that the lab and Chinese authorities have methodically attempted to conceal these activities.
I start to get suspicious and start to investigate.
You have to play games to try to, you know, get the data. And China is really good at removing things, but if you get there on time, you can get an awful lot.
There's been a lot of important information that's come out as a result of what they're calling internet sleuths, but it's people who are just recognizing that our world is at risk and our governments and the UN system weren't doing what needed to be done.
When the WHO looked into the question in early 2021, it concluded that a lab leak was extremely unlikely. But the report was criticized due to the team's lack of access to key data. President Biden has since asked US intelligence agencies to look into the matter, but so far there has been no thorough international investigation.
Up to now, we have not had an investigation of the origins of COVID-19. The China WHO joint study has been widely described as an investigation by a lot of media, but they admit that they never had the mandate and they never had the powers or influence to be able to go in there and investigate. So all the evidence right now is circumstantial. We need to have a credible investigation.
If it does turn out that this pandemic was caused by a lab leak, it's going to change the practice of virology forever, everywhere.
Although the lab leak theory has recently gained traction, there is still no definitive proof of either a market origin or a lab leak, and both theories remain plausible. But the whole controversy around the origin of the coronavirus has deflected from the larger and arguably more important question whether high-risk research with deadly pathogens should be pursued at all.
The reason being that accidents happen, and they happen a lot, even from the highest security labs.
And it happens all over the world, internationally, not any one particular country.
As a result of a slew of accidents in US labs involving bird flu, Ebola, and anthrax, in 2014, the Obama administration put a moratorium on gain-of-function research. But the ban was full of loopholes.
First of all, it was a funding moratorium. You could go on working. If you had money from someplace else, from some other government, or out of your own university, you could go and do what you want. And of course, people went all over the world and continued to do it.
The U.S. moratorium, however limited, was lifted in 2017. But even if there are demonstrable and important scientific gains resulting from this type of research, the question remains, are the risks worth it?
Such work can be important because you can argue that by such studies, we will understand better what it takes to block it if an epidemic appears. But at the same time, you're going to ask, as an interested, intelligent person, not a virologist, you can say, yeah, but by doing so, aren't you creating something that will be more infectious for humans? The answer is yes, but we're learning. And you could say, yes, you're learning, but are you weighing the scale between risk and benefit? Is the gain, which you're not even sure of, this much, but the risk is this much? Isn't that really plausible here? And if so, should we be doing those experiments? I think that's a legitimate discussion.
What's happened in biology is very analogous to cybersecurity, where the technology has just leapt ahead way beyond the governance. Our governance of these things is sitting in the last century, right? But the technology has just steamed ahead.
It cannot be that individual scientists are making species-wide decisions. That doesn't mean there's not a very important role for scientists, but we need to have broader, more inclusive, more democratic frameworks for figuring out the best ways forward.
I would not ban it, but I would ask it to be reviewed with international standards. And I would have on committees people beyond expert virologists.
I think the public needs to be involved. So definitely this problem should not be regulated by scientists and then performed by scientists ourselves. So because the outcomes of a pandemic, it's not just that only scientists get sick, everybody gets sick. So it affects the whole globe. That's why this sort of research where the risks are extremely high they need to be discussed with non-scientists as well.
I think we need community consultation. We need the community engaged and knowledgeable. We actually did some research to find out how much do people in the general community know about this stuff, and it's very little. And when you give them the information, sort of factual information, they don't find it acceptable. You know, they don't find it acceptable to begin with, but the more information you give people, the less acceptable it becomes for them. So I think, you know, we need to involve the community, because the community is the most important stakeholder for which all the benefits and the harms apply.
There should be transparency. It is not normal that the public didn't know before what was gain of function. The society has the right to know what is being done.
The worst case scenario is we have another pandemic that's much worse than this one, and we're entering the age of synthetic biology where it's easy to imagine a much more dangerous pathogen than the one we are facing now. This could be a life or death moment for our species, and we have this opportunity of this pandemic, as terrible as it's been, to learn the lessons. And to learn those lessons, we need to do a fearless examination of what went wrong.
With the growing number of labs in the world now working with these dangerous pathogens, collecting them, studying them, maybe doing a bit of gain-of-functional research with them, we are entering an era where it's quite likely that there will be a lab-based pandemic. And if we don't deal with that, we're just flying blind.
Regardless of the true origins of the COVID-19 virus, which we may never know for sure, society still needs to grapple with where to draw the line for research that's done with good intentions and in good faith, but that could put all of humanity at risk if anything goes wrong.
Remember the time you said goodbye.
En dat waren de Yes in Long Distance Run Around. We luisterden naar een reportage van Deutsche Welle News. En het ging over de gain of function experimenten. Dat is een beste, hele gevaarlijke, dat zijn hele gevaarlijke technologieën waarbij pathogenen, dus dat kunnen virussen, dat kunnen bacteriën zijn of andere pathogenen, versterkt worden in hun agressiviteit. En veranderd, genetisch veranderd worden, genetisch gemodificeerd worden, om ze gevaarlijker te maken. En het idee is dat je hierdoor beter pandemie kan begrijpen of betere vaccin kan ontwikkelen. Maar volgens de onderzoekster Alina Chan, moleculair bioloog, is dat nog nooit gebeurd. Tot nu toe heeft geen enkele gain-of-function-experiment echt zinvolle vooruitgangen geboekt voor de wereld, voor de mensen. Er bestaan alleen heel veel risico's. Dit reportage ging daarover. Er zijn een aantal experts geïnterviewd. Raina McIntyre, Milton Leitenberg, Robert Gallo en Alina Chan. Er zijn ook experimenten genoemd die in Rotterdam plaatsgevonden hebben over de ook gain-of-function experimenten. In het voorjaar van 2020 kwam een artikel uit. Die was geschreven door Pieter Datzak en getekend door andere 27 vooraanstaande wetenschappers. Die zei dat de theorie van de lab leak, dus van de laboratorium oorsprong van de virus, totaal ongeloofwaardig was. Dus het debat was op dat moment helemaal afgelopen. Mensen die wat anders beweerden, die werden bestempeld als complotdenkers en gewoon genegeerd door het debat. Dit gebeurde in 2020. Maar later bleek dat Pieter Datzak wel de voorzitter was van een NGO die enorm veel geld kreeg vanuit de Amerikaanse overheid om juist gain-of-function experimenten te doen in onder andere in Wuhan. Onder andere met Xi Jinping, de bad woman. Dus ja, enorme belangen, conflicten uiteraard, zou je moeten zeggen. En later is er meer onderzoek gedaan en veel meer aandacht voor deze gain-of-function experimenten. Het probleem is dat je met gain-of-function pathogenen kan veranderen. Dan kunnen ze agressiever worden, dan kunnen ze makkelijk in de lucht verspreid worden. Dus ja, het is, vanzelfsprekend wordt dit, is dit heel gevaarlijk en met heel veel risico's. Je kan onder andere, dit heeft Alina Chan gezegd, je kan het genoom veranderen op een manier dat het niet te zien is dat dit genetisch gemodificeerd is, dat dit engineered is. Maar dat betekent dat je geen bewijzen kan hebben dat een genoom kunstmatig veranderd is. En de vraag is natuurlijk, ja, voordelen en nadelen. Wat betekent dit voor de maatschappij? Wat hebben we hieraan? Krijgen wij hierdoor betere vaccins? Worden we beter beschermd tegen pandemieën? Tot nu toe is dat niet gebeurd. Wat is wel gebeurd? Ja, we hebben nu te maken met een virus, met een onbekende virus die ontzettend veel muteert. Nu hebben we weer een nieuwe variant. En we gaan niet eens onderzoeken naar de oorzaak van hoe kon dit virus ontstaan? Dus heel veel vragen en heel veel suggesties vanuit deze wetenschappers. Wat moet je gaan doen? Je moet het publiek in ieder geval bij betrekken. Je moet kijken naar voordelen, nadelen. Je moet inclusief zijn, democratisch. Je moet internationale standaards hebben. En op deze manier dan zou je eventueel dit soort onderzoeken kunnen uitvoeren. We zijn aan het einde gekomen van deze uitzending van Radio Onda Italiana. Nog even wat noten van Sona Giobarte. En dan ga ik afsluiten. Dit was Voice of the Town van Radio Onda Italiana. Silvia Terribili in de studio. Hartelijk dank voor jullie aandacht en graag tot de volgende keer. U luisterde naar Voice of the Town. Een programma van Radio Onda Italiana op Radio Salto Amsterdam. Op woensdagavond van 8 tot 9. Voice of the Town.